Hey, it's Andrew here, and welcome to the Ecom Fuel Podcast, the show dedicated to helping seven and eight-figure brand owners build incredible businesses and amazing lives. And today on the show, we're going to be doing part two, wrapping up some of the lessons, learnings, thoughts, takeaways from the Ecom Fuel Trends Report. I kicked off the first version of this last week where we talked about the top four takeaways from the report. I'll go over those in just a minute here. In crazy rapid fire, in case you missed that. But the meat of today is going to be talking about some of the other, maybe less headline breaking, more nuanced, but still very important takeaways across business model shifts, what happened with tariffs, some of the surprising data that I found around financial knowledge relative to outcomes for entrepreneurs, when to take money out of your business, operations, warehouses, and the future of e-com and how people are thinking about it. So it's a fun one, a lot of good ones in here. If you want the full report, you can head on over to ecommercefuel.com/blueprint. And that will take you to all of the findings, the big takeaways, as well as a place where you can download the entire 55-page PDF, which goes really in-depth, gives you the lay of the land, but also tells you what you should be doing for your business, how you should be thinking and reacting to these findings, as well as a benchmarking report and tables where you can compare your business performance across a dozen metrics, you know, to other stores in your revenue cohort. So lots of good stuff there. Again, that's ecommercefuel.com/blueprint. But today, have you here on the mic. So let's go ahead and get into the second half of the takeaways. Like I mentioned, I'm not going to get into these in much detail. I'm going to give you just the bullets with maybe one or two thoughts. But in case you missed last week, and also to frame up the rest of these takeaways, the big four takeaways from the report that we covered last time, that heavy paid traffic spenders are growing three times as fast, not surprising, but without sacrificing their profit margins. That is surprising. And we talked about how really it wasn't ad performance that was driving this. It was the structure of their business. They designed a business with high margins, low overhead, that allowed them the margin to spend on ads. And that's how they were doing so well. The second big takeaway was most stores, 72%, have adopted AI. Not surprising. The surprising part, it did not generate any financial advantage at all. Or at least there was no meaningful difference between the two cohorts. I thought this was pretty interesting. And the more I thought about it, like we talked about yesterday and actually the week before, a lot of fun things. It's easy to play around with great tech without being more disciplined about what you build. So anyway, I think this is not a long-term trend. I think as AI gets better and as people become a little savvier about working it into their businesses and workflows, this will start to generate a payoff, but we haven't seen it yet. Third takeaway, the big one, was Amazon's share of revenue fell to 2017 levels, despite more people than ever selling on the platform. Big takeaway here for me is Amazon has moved from a growth channel to a supplemental channel. It's gone from, you know, only half of people selling on it to more than like two-thirds of people selling on it. And yet the revenue that it continues to generate has been falling for at least for the last 3 or 4 or 5 years. Back down to 2017 levels. And actually, it was kind of funny, the timing with this report coming out, because yeah, a lot of people had some real issue with fees going, you know, really hitting, being announced from Amazon this week. So I think that's kind of paints that picture and why that's happening. I think people are getting a little, starting to build their business more concentratedly on their own website. And takeaway number four, gross margins hit all-time highs, while net margins hit all-time lows. People are making more on the product side and less on the net side, which was kind of an interesting tale of two margins. The good news, the silver lining there, is just more aggregate profit overall. If you look at net income, it's grown faster than the margin contraction on the net income side. But still, for people starting out today, it's a little bit of a trickier environment, which, you know, is not surprising. It's more mature, but it's just what it is. So those are the big four takeaways from the report. So today, new things I want to dive into. First one is talking about business model shifts and kind of what has been happening with the types of businesses people are running. More of the detail behind some of these things. And so if you look at the business models, there's the ones that we usually track over the last almost decade, manufacturers, resellers, someone who's doing a hybrid, doing a little bit of both, private label, and drop shipping. Those are the big five. And what is fascinating is if you look at the change in those business models over the last 3 years, the number of people who have gone to manufacturing has gone up 50%. And every other business model type has either stayed the same or declined. Resellers stayed about the same, but hybrid went from like 20 to 14%. Private label went from 18 to 11%. Drop shipping went from 9 to 4%. Everyone is going to manufacturing, which is fascinating. Not to say you can't make the other ones work, but it's a lot harder to make that ads-driven model work if you don't have the extra margin that comes from manufacturing. Competitive advantage movement, we track the same thing as well. And you see a very similar story there. The number of people selling proprietary products went from, you know, 25 to 35%, you know, almost again, almost a 15, not quite a 50% jump, but close. And every other category lost ground or stayed the same. Marketing expertise stayed the same. Customer service, the number of people who differentiated there was pretty, you know, similar. Industry expertise slipped a little bit. Branding and storytelling slipped a little bit. Lowest cost slipped a little bit. Everything just and not huge jumps, but everyone is moving to manufacturing their own proprietary products, which I found interesting and makes sense, but seeing the data was confirming. So in terms of takeaways, what does this mean for us? I think it means that while you don't have to be manufacturing your own product, think about, you know, about 40%-ish of people are not manufacturing their own products. It doesn't mean you're doomed, but it does mean you need to think really seriously about what is my defensible edge here? If it's not being vertically integrated with a proprietary product and a higher margin that lets me spend on ads, you know, is it customization? Is it, you know, I don't know what it is. There's a lot of different ways you can go with that, but I think that's just something you need to be able to answer very clearly and with some conviction. Otherwise, it's going to be harder to make things work. So the second thing I want to get into is tariffs. So obviously, a huge year on tariffs. The section I titled for 2025, I titled the section of the report "The Most Fun We've Had Since COVID," which about sums up how much people enjoyed this debacle this year. The big story here. So you remember when tariffs were coming down? Everyone's looking at inflation, and I won't say inflation was low, but I think there was a meaningful number of people who thought, like, "Wow, I'm surprised inflation is not higher with all these tariffs coming down the pipe." And what we found was that of the people, of the stores and brands that were impacted by tariffs, which means that they actually had a price increase, not everyone did. Some people, there was a meaningful number that did not get impacted. But of the people that did get impacted by tariffs, those brands absorbed 58% of the costs, the additional product costs that were incurred, you know, that came as a result of tariffs. So they only raised their prices for every $10 increase in their materials, they only increased them $6 as opposed to the full $10. No, excuse me, they only raised the prices $4. They absorbed $6 in margin loss. And that is one of the reasons I think why inflation was not quite as high as people expected. Another interesting finding here was that only 4% of US brands are moving their supply chains to America as a result of the tariffs. So obviously that's the big impetus behind why these got rolled out, or at least, you know, seemingly. But yeah, 4.3% moving their supply chains to the US, about 10% are giving it serious consideration, pretty even 50% just didn't even consider it, and about 35% are giving it some consideration, but only 4% actively moving, which is kind of crazy. One other, I found this slightly ironic in the tariff front. We asked all the store owners what their biggest struggle in business was during 2025. I thought tariffs was going to be number one or number two. It wasn't even the top three, maybe even the top four. Yeah, it was definitely not top three. So the number one hiring, or the number one struggle for businesses, and this shouldn't come as a surprise, right? Was hiring teams and people. Like the best part, the most challenging part of any business is us messy humans, right? That's number one. Marketing was number two. Growth and revenue is number three. So actually, you could probably lump those together. So maybe the growth and the marketing is actually number one. But tariffs, 5% of us said that tariffs were the biggest challenge. And so to me, it's kind of this double-edged sword, right? Like on one hand, that's great. Tariffs did not kill the year, right? On the other hand, it's like, man, business is hard. if this is, you know, if tariffs barely even got a mention in the grand scheme of things, it's a good reminder that a lot of the stuff that we do as entrepreneurs every day in and out in e-com and otherwise is challenging. So give yourself some grace there. So what does this all mean? You know, I'm giving these stats, numbers, talking about how business is hard. Thanks, Andrew, for, wow, these are just masterclass in Insights 101. I think this means the biggest takeaway here, if you're a store owner, if you were impacted by tariffs, is to raise your prices and probably to raise them more. At a bare minimum, make sure you are covering that margin hit. And that means, as we talked about last week, and I talked about the top, gross, you know, profit margins, you know, people are making less. And so being able to raise those prices to recoup 100% at least of that is super important. And maybe you've done the testing. Maybe you've gone through, maybe you got hit with a tariff, maybe you've done some quasi-scientific testing to say, hey, okay, we tried to pass this on. It didn't work when we were optimizing for profit across a 2, 4, 6, 8 week period. We realized we couldn't pass it on and our profit profile was better by not raising prices. Okay, if you've done that, awesome. Don't listen to me anymore. But I'm guessing the vast majority of us in this situation have not raised prices to the point to really push to see how far we can go to try to recoup that margin because we're afraid of it. It's hard. It's scary. I've been there. But I've also been on the backside of raising prices and realizing that's the best thing usually in terms of the strongest, most powerful lever in your business to impact change the fastest. So anyway, that is my little TED talk here on raising your prices as a result, just in general, but also especially if you got hit and absorbed more of those tariff costs than you should have, which statistically, there's a good chance you did. All right, let's move on to financial intelligence and the implications. So coming into this area, I am biased. I've got a financial background. If you're a carpenter, you think everything looks like a nail, guilty as charged. I'm not coming into this objectively. But I feel a little vindicated with the data that we pulled. One of the things I asked this year was for operators and owners to rank themselves in terms of their financial intelligence out of 5 stars. So one star to 5 stars. And I then was able to take those rankings and compare them to performance of their businesses, the amount of kind of runway they had in the bank personally, or just, you know, money in the bank in terms of cash reserves. And it was really eye-opening to see the difference. The biggest thing, I'll get to the numbers here in a minute, but the big takeaway is you would think that going from like a 1 to a 3 or 1 to a 4 would give you a massive jump, right? Like no brainer, makes sense. But I think what was most surprising is the jump from going from a 4 to a 5 is where you saw just a huge increase in metrics, meaning good enough isn't good enough. Pretty good is still leaving a ton on the table. And that maybe the 80-20, you know, Pareto principle here doesn't apply. For example, if you look at, you know, people who had a 3 out of 5 self-rated financial knowledge, their average net margin controlled for business size was about 8.9%. 4 out of 5 was 9.7. So you get a little bit of a bump going from 3 to 4, but you go to 5 out of 5 and it jumps from a 9.7 to a 14.3. So you're up like 45% when before you had maybe a, you know, a 15-11% jump. So when you go from a 4 to 5 from runway, your runway doubles in terms of cash in the bank. Your net income growth goes up significantly. You're extracting capital at a higher rate. So for me, what this means is when I think about what's important in a business, I would argue apart from understanding your market and your product exceptionally well, the next best thing you can do for your financial performance for your business is to be deeply financially fluent. So a lot of things there. How do you do that? Studying up on this, you know, understanding your financial statements, the income statement, the balance sheet, cash flows, understanding how to do a cash flow forecast. That's hugely important. Econ businesses eat money. And if you're not, eat cash, I should say. And if you're not, you know, forecasting your cash flow, you can get into real trouble. There's a lot there. So worth spending the time to go from that 4 to 5 out of 5. And actually built a course. If you've been listening to the podcast for a while, we just wrapped up in the first half of, or the first quarter of 2026, our series on financial mastery. If you missed that, I bundled that all together into a PDF course and a series. It's free for listeners. It takes you from everything from just getting started to walking all the way through how to think about understanding financial statements, where to focus, why you should invest outside your business, how to change mindsets at certain point. It's kind of a comprehensive thing. And you can take that if you'd like. ecommercetool.com/mastery is where you can learn more about that. All right, next section, capital extraction. I should probably call this dividends. Capital extraction sounds like some kind of abusive mining operation somewhere in Canada. Pulling money out of your business, dividends, capital extraction, however you want to call it. Really interesting, something I haven't looked at before in this study. And the big takeaway here, we're getting a nuance here, is that most owners are not seeing financial rewards from their business until they hit at least meaningful financial rewards, I should say, until the mid to upper 7 figures. And, you know, why It's a little disheartening, but if you're an e-com owner, you know you're building a lot of enterprise value as you grow. Enterprise value is the value of your business. If you turned around today and sold it, you would, what you're building has value on the market. It might be hard to extract because you have to sell the whole business early on, but it has value. So it's not like you're doing this for free. But in terms of us looking at how can you, you know, when can you start taking money out of the business without selling it? That's what was really the focus here. When you're new, you know, you're not, we found that almost no one that was under $1 million was taking dividends. The number of people under $1 million taking meaningful dividends was 6%, you know, about 1 in 20. And that makes sense. You're brand new, you're growing fast, you should be reinvesting everything. If you're growing quickly, that also is an area where, you know, 40, 50% plus, you're not going to be extracting capital because it's really difficult to finance a fast growing e-com business, even if you have great financing lined up, because everything is going back in to financing and paying for that inventory that continues to grow and grow and grow and grow. So at the two ends of the barbell, people aren't pulling money out. It's much more possible as you scale. And we actually looking at the data, the sweet spot that I found between balancing your net income growth, taking some dividends, having an optimistic outlook for the future, which is kind of a rough proxy for how good do I feel about the future of this business, was in the mid to upper seven figure range and having growth that was 25-ish percent or lower. And that seemed like it was a spot where, a sweet spot, taking money out of the business without shooting yourself in the foot for future prospects, but also giving yourself a chance to invest outside the business. That was one of, if you do go through that financial mastery class or you caught the episodes before, I'm a big believer in once you build up some momentum and some scale and get a little stability, it's so important to start pulling some money out and diversifying away from your core business. You can check out the course or the previous podcast on that, but it's a deep conviction of mine. So what is the takeaway here? I think the takeaway is don't sweat this if you're an upstart. Don't sweat this if you've decided to grow really quickly. But if you're in that phase, mid to upper seven figures, moderated growth, you should be taking some money regularly out of your business. Maybe not insane amounts, but meaning, you know, a moderate dividend, small to moderate dividends. And you can actually check to see, again, going back to those benchmarking tables that we put together in the trends report, you can get a sense of how much different stores at different levels of growth are taking out. So reference those if that's helpful. But if you're not thinking about that, you should. And you should also be thinking about diversifying if you're in that phase, your net worth outside of your business. So those, I think, are the takeaways for this section. All right, finally, operations. The super sexy world of warehouses and forklifts and team structures and inventory turns, all this fun stuff. Headline here was that warehouse ownership was correlated with significantly slower growth. And I'm not going to say causation. I don't want to say warehouse ownership causes this, but there was such a strong correlation here. And if you owned a warehouse, your average growth was about 4%. And if you either leased or outsourced your warehouse, your growth, your revenue growth was somewhere in the range of 30 to 35%, almost, you know, a 9x increase in some cases on average. And this blew me away. And I think, you know, thinking about this, I don't know if it is a, it was funny seeing some of the responses I've heard anecdotally chatting, have conversations with people or seeing some responses online. I've had at least two or three people say they've seen this in their own experience. People, you know, once you start investing a lot in the warehouse in terms of capital, attention, things like that, you don't have the attention to focus on the growth side of things. I think that's maybe one aspect of it. Maybe another aspect of it is once you get to a business where your ROI for growth is declining or for launching new products, or you get stalled out, owning your own warehouse is potentially a place that makes more sense to start putting cash as your opportunity cost other places comes down. That could be one. I'm not sure what it is, but it was a pretty stark correlation between growth. One other thing too is to consider is like durability of a business. If you've got, you know, maybe you're not growing as fast and you own your own warehouse because you have to, because you fulfill and you have the world's largest selection of custom replacement parts for model trains built in the, you know, 1970s and 1990s. And you're not growing as fast, but you can charge an insane premium for them. But that means you have to have a huge warehouse. I mean, that I can't measure the defensibility of a business. Anyway, I'm giving a lot of caveats here, but I thought that was an interesting thing to keep in mind. A couple other things that were interesting is the inventory burden you have versus performance. So your inventory as a percent of revenue, and probably not surprising here, but the more inventory you have, not only do the more working capital do you have tied up, but your growth decreases in terms of your top line revenue growth, the more inventory you have, and your margin decreases as well. So if you're, you know, less than 5% of your, if your inventory makes up less than 5% of your annual revenue, you've got 11.5% net margins. If you're 20% plus, you're at, you know, half of that, 6.5% net margins. And you're drastically more likely in a linear fashion to say you had the hardest year ever last year, the more inventory you have. Same thing with inventory turns, how quickly you turn your inventory. So an inventory turn is how often, how many times you sell through your average inventory throughout the year. And one thing that was interesting here was you would think always faster is better. And that's very true up to about 5 to 6 inventory turns per year. But then once you go over 7, the revenue growth and net income growth fall off a cliff, which to me was kind of interesting in terms of how you interpret that. Maybe that means that you're not buying in enough quantity and hitting MOQs to get those margin, you know, get the margin you need. Maybe it's just because you're such a just-in-time company that you're leaving that on the table. I'm not sure what that means, but it seemed like the sweet spot for inventory turns was 5 to 6 times per year. And then finally, operationally, last point here before I get to actually what you can do about this, fixed costs. We talked about this a little bit last time in terms of building a company that can support heavy advertising spend. But the more fixed costs you have of in terms of overhead, the more it hurts your performance and net margins. And it seemed like the cutoff here was about 20%. So if you went over 20% of your overhead as a percent of revenue, you do, let's say you do $10 million per year in revenue. And if you have over, you know, $2 million or over of overhead per year, that's where you really start to see a real hit in terms of margins getting compressed. So quick rule of thumb, you can do the benchmarking guides in the full report to give you real granular data on where you are. But rough rule of thumb, if your overhead's over 20%, that's something you should start worrying about. The big takeaway here for me is be ruthless about your catalog size, right? Like every SKU you have demands working capital space analysis to make sure it's profitable on a contribution margin advertising. So really think carefully about your SKU size and make sure things are earning their keep. Be thoughtful about if you really need to run and own your own warehouse, right? Like sometimes you do. There is a real downside to outsourcing and 3PL. And the more SKUs you have, the harder that is to do well. And the more custom your business, the harder it is to do well. But there's a real correlation between owning a warehouse and how quickly you're going to grow. It's just the facts. So, and then again, overhead. I already mentioned it, but make sure you keep those fixed overheads at, you know, rule of thumb, 20% or below. So finally, looking forward into the future, what are priorities for people? I love this. I titled the section Optimistic, Lean, and Betting on AI. 80% of store owners are optimistic about the future. And I love this. Like this is, you know, and I will say, if you think about e-com looking forward in 2026 versus the last 5 years, it does not feel easy, but it feels like there are some silver linings of hope here. AI, yes, hasn't produced a meaningful ROI yet for people. But if you think about the industries that are probably compared to software, I'd much rather be in e-com over the last 6 months. I think AI has the potential to actually add value in terms of, you know, operational efficiencies to e-commerce much more than software in terms of, you know, the especially competitive pressures. I mean, the nice thing about e-com is that you got a real world component, right? You can take AI, assuming it gets implemented well and you can figure out the ROI curve on here and help it with internal processes, with marketing, while you still have this defensible moat of something in the physical world that AI is not going to disrupt. So I think that's a cool part of the AI story in the future. I think, you know, tariffs are still kind of a hot mess with the Supreme Court decision and a few other things, but it seems like there's the potential for those not just being a stranglehold and an anchor on the industry. Yeah, and I think in general, the community is optimistic about the future, which is super cool to see. I think number one priority for 2026 was AI and automation. Number two is marketing and advertising. Number three was simplify, focus, and cut SKUs. So really kind of streamlining those operations. Those are the top three. And one thing that was interesting was the hopefulness by revenue scaled almost exactly linearly. If you go from 1 million up to 50 million plus, at every revenue boost, there was a, you know, it wasn't huge, but there was a slight uptick every time in terms of hopefulness for the future. Kind of makes sense, right? Like the bigger you are, the more established you are, it's hard to get stuff built. I found that kind of interesting. Close on this in terms of who's optimistic for the future and who's pessimistic. I took those two groups, people who rated their hope for the future at a 9 out of 10 or 10 out of 10, and the pessimists who rated it for 6 out of 10 or lower. If you look at their metrics, conversion rate for the optimistic owners was significantly higher. The optimistic owners turned their inventory more quickly, about 33% faster. They had less inventory as a percent of revenue. They were 50% more likely to lease a warehouse. They were 50% less likely to own a warehouse. Maybe that math is, you know, am I doing that math right on the fly? Someone would probably call me out when they look at the report, but that's pretty close. They had less overhead fixed costs. And so, you know, when you think about looking forward, efficiency is a big theme for optimism looking forward into the future. Probably not surprised after my two podcasts, but probably a good thing to kind of cap us on here. So that's a wrap on this year's report. Also, big congratulations to Yuri in the community. He won the round trip business class ticket anywhere in the world. Congratulations, sir. Thank you for being a part of the community and the survey and everyone who participated. It takes a lot of time to fill this out. Every year, you know, I already have a bunch of notes for things that I want to do better next year. So thank you, everyone who's given me feedback and suggestions. Always aiming to make this more helpful and more accurate, but always fun to do and really appreciate everyone who was involved. Hope it was helpful. Forging what matters. Dad, I don't know if you can tell, but morale is extremely high. This was my daughter on the first day we brought the puppy home. She walked up to me with this calm, almost diplomatic energy. No gloating, not even being overly emotional, just a measured status report. She'd been asking or has been asking for a dog for a decade of lobbying. And this was her victory speech and confirmation that it was worth it. I kind of respected the restraint a little bit. For the record, I never wanted a dog. My friends will sometimes call me the robot. I'm an optimizer. I'm an efficiency guy. My brain runs on systems and logic and logistics and ROI, and a puppy has terrible ROI. We traveled for the last, 7 years extensively as a family. We're on the road a lot or moving back and forth. And the who's going to watch the dog was kind of my undefeated excuse for years to not to have to get one. And this last year, we settled down in Montana, a lot less moving around. And suddenly my excuse arsenal was empty. I didn't cave because I wanted to. I caved because I ran out of reasons not to. And because I love my family. And I especially love my kids who were lobbying hard. 2 weeks in, here's what I didn't expect to puppy ownership. I kind of like the little guy. He was running around while my daughter and I did a fun little workout session this morning in the garage. He peed on the floor mid-session, and even somehow it was still more fun with him there. He just lightens things up. It's fun taking breaks between reps and wrestling with him and having him run all over the place. And my family loves catching me in these little acts. Anytime I pick him up or ruffle his ears or show even the slightest affection, I get the look of, whoa, dad likes the puppy. He was wrong. Like they're documenting some kind of like rare wildlife sighting or horrific lie being told in court. But I think the moment that really got me was walking into my living room the other day, or maybe I was just sitting reading a book and didn't notice until a few minutes later. But I look over and my son, who runs around like a feral child with his shirt off like Tarzan about 80% of the time, was passed out shirtless on the couch with the puppy burrowed up under a blanket against his chest. And both of them were completely at peace and happy. And that image isn't leaving my head anytime soon. Is a dog going to make travel harder when we do want to go? Probably. Yeah, it's going to be a pain. Is he inconvenient and inefficient? Absolutely. I already have a trip this weekend that I'm annoyed that we're going to have to figure out what to do with this little dog. But I tend to run my life like a spreadsheet sometimes, and spreadsheets don't capture your son asleep with a puppy on his chest. And they don't capture your daughter's face when morale is extremely high. Sometimes a little inefficiency is the whole point. Before you go, here's a number that stuck with me from my research this year. Store owners who rate their financial knowledge a 5 out of 5 has almost 50% higher net margins than owners who rate themselves a 4. Same businesses, same industries, but going from pretty good to confident was worth almost 50% more money in their pocket. If you want to close that gap, check out our Financial Mastery Series course. It's a free course built specifically for e-com owners like you. that you can download at ecommercefuel.com/mastery. And if you're a 7 or 8 figure store owner who wants to be around other operators taking this stuff seriously, make sure to check out our community at ecomfuel.com. Work hard, adventure often. I'm looking forward to seeing you again next Friday.